For decades, economists told farmers to get big or get out. Others, the heretics of agriculture, told farmers to grow small and stand tall. This divergence of opinion leads one to ask, which will feed the world, big or small?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 762nd edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in St. Petersport who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are, when wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Easton Allen on the boards. Hello, Easton.
Hello, good morning.
Folks, for decades, ag economists have told farmers they must get big or get out. And so farmers got big and bigger and biggest. As a consequence, we now have ever fewer farmers growing ever fewer crops on ever larger parcels of land. Others, the heretics of agriculture, have been telling farmers to grow small and stand tall. And so a few farmers have been experimenting with bringing the ages-old technologies of space-intensive production into modern times with some really amazing results. Whereas as big agriculture requires up to 30,000 square feet to feed one person, small agriculture can feed that one person in only 4,000 square feet. And here's the kicker. Where big agriculture requires lots of expensive inputs like equipment, fuel, chemical pesticides and herbicides, and so on and on and on, small farmers can grow the food with almost no inputs from the outside. This difference between big agriculture and small agriculture leads us to ask, which will feed the world, big or small? And folks, here to help us see things on the small side, we have one of the big men of small farms around the world, big farms or small farms and gardens, Mr. John Jevons, who is the author of Get This, How to Grow More Vegetables and Fruits, Nuts, Berries, Grains, and Other Crops Than You Can Ever Thought Possible on Less Land Than You Can Possibly Imagine.
Hi, good morning.
Good to have you aboard. Thank you for joining us. Your book, How to Grow More, has been on my bookshelf for 30 years, so I'm looking forward to this today. We're going to have a little fun. And first question, I guess, how are things up in Willits, California today?
Well, they're really rainy. In fact, we had to switch phones in order to make this possible because the rain knocked out one of our phones comparatively.
Oh, okay. So we're on rain-drenched time then, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, good. We can use the rain this year, and we'll ride with what we can get here. John, how did a political science student go about becoming world-renowned authority on space-intensive farming and gardening? How on earth did you do that? I mean, your book, How to Grow More Vegetables, like I said, has been on my bookshelf for 30 years, an indispensable part of my library. And it's on the bookshelves of 500,000 other people around the world. So, but how did a political science student grow into becoming this authority on space-intensive production?
Well, I always loved gardening. When I was 2 years old, my aunt and uncle in Pennsylvania on their farm had a kitchen garden, and I just really adored that. They had a grape arbor, and I was fascinated. I grew up in Arizona. When I was 9, I lived in a subdivision house that used to be a grapefruit orchard, and the chickens and the ducks that were under one of the grapefruit trees caused a transformation. That tree produced at least 4 times the fruit that the other trees did, and I didn't really think about it at the time, but it must have had some kind of effect. At any rate, in the very early 1970s, I had a question. You know, in addition to loving food raising and practicing organic gardening in my backyard, I wanted to know, what's the smallest area that you can grow all your food, money, clothing, and other agricultural products in? in an environmentally sound way, in an equitable way, so that if everyone used that technique or a similarly effective one, that everyone could live well.
Now, John, how on earth did you come to that question? I mean, when you were that age, other young men are thinking about other questions.
Yeah, well, this, when I asked that question, yeah, that's true. I was asking a question when I was, I guess, about 21 or something. I was asking this. I don't know why. We traveled to the Central Valley where 30% of all the food for the United States was being grown at the time and looked for a farm. And I asked people this question, what's the smallest area? And they said, well, we don't know, but if you have 1,000 acres of wheat, and it's a good year, you can pay your bills. So I realized that there were three things I needed to face. One is that nobody knew the answer to my question. And two, that large-scale farming wasn't working. Actually, subsequently, not immediately, but very soon, for a 10-year period, each year, 100,000 farmers in the United States went bankrupt. And the third thing that I realized was that if I wanted to know the answer, it was tag. I was it. We looked around.
So if somebody's going to come up with an answer, it has to be you, right?
Well, I don't know if it had to be me. If somebody else had come up with it, it'd have been okay. I would have just then done it. So we looked around the Central Valley still for some farmland, but every time I saw a big farm, I could only really see small ones. So we returned to the San Francisco Bay Area and began the Common Ground Organic Gardening and Mini Farming Project with Ecology Action in Palo Alto.
And you, as I understand it, you were given a parking lot to work with, right?
No, that's sort of the reverse, but the parking lot was in there. We were very kindly given by the Syntex Corporation 3 3/4 acres to do this research, development, and teaching on. And we took about, something like a quarter of an acre of that and used it for our purposes. And we gave the rest to the community as a community garden. Later, that area had to be, you know, given back to the company. And we knew that it could happen anytime because the company needed it for expansion. And in the Joni Mitchell song terms, you know, paradise got turned into a parking lot.
Ah, the other way around then.
Yeah.
And parking lots became more valuable than food.
Well, I think so. But actually, when you look at what Michael Norton did at Conakai Farms in Berkeley on a quarter acre of planted surface, he was able to raise, in his best year, $235,000 gross on a quarter of an acre of planted surface while paying his farm workers 2.5 times the going rate and still netted on that quarter of an acre $50,000. That was using biologically intensive food raising.
Mm-hmm. And thus, the whole notion of biologically intensive production comes into the fore. Is this something new in the world, this whole notion of biointensive farming?
Absolutely not. It goes back, at the very least, into Asia 4 millennia ago. That's China, Korea, and Japan. It may go back as far as 5,000 years ago to Ethiopia, but we haven't been able to check that out completely. Coming into the more recent time, 2,000 years ago, it was used in Greece successfully. We found that food grew much better in landslides, or actually plants. And so then they began to do raised beds because they sort of mimic landslides where you get more planting surface area and more for absorbing heat, more area for absorbing water in the form of rain, and you can actually put more plants into it. Then coming up into the very much more recent time, 1,000 years ago, the Mayans actually were able to thrive as a civilization when the other cultures around them were deteriorating, and they did it by neighborhood, biologically intensive food raising.
Can you hold that? We're going to take a quick break. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host today. We're having a lot of fun with John Jevons, the big man of small farms from a rain-drenched Willits, California, where he holds out with his teaching farm up there. And, of course, you as well. Our phone number is today, 831-479-1080, and the subject is space-intensive production for farms and gardens. Which will feed the world, big farms or small farms? Give a listen to John Jevons and see what you think right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, folks, agriculture, like most businesses here in the developed world, seems to be growing in two directions. Farms seem to be getting very, very big or very, very small. And everything in the middle seems to be like roadkill, with the exception of a few Amish farmers. And even they seem to be the target of recent federal government efforts to get rid of them. So who knows what's going to be left in the middle. Conventional wisdom has it that farmers should get big or get out. And so our farmers have become very big and keep getting bigger. There are fewer and fewer farmers growing fewer and fewer crops on larger and larger parcels of land. But there are others in the world, some who would call them heretics, like John Jevons, who say, wait a minute, there's a whole other world here of space-intensive production technology that we should look at and that we should use to grow food. And John is looking back in history and finding all kinds of examples, the last of which we talked about was the Mayan culture, correct, John?
That's right. I'd like to mention some other examples. A lot of people feel, gosh, I can't raise all my own food. It's going to take too much time. And without getting into a lot of numbers or details, let's go back to 10,000 years ago in northern Iran, where the people raising predominantly einkorn hornamani, which was the original spelt wheat, not the one that we currently use, they actually raised all their calories with just 20 hours of work a year. It was 20 minutes a day for 60 days. It's been documented.
Wait a minute. Why don't we do that? That sounds like fun. And have all the rest of our time to do the things we want to do. What happened, John? Why did we lose that?
I'm not really sure. First, I should mention that calories are the most important. It takes about at least 90% of your growing area to produce your calories, either with grains or special root crops that concentrate calories very well. And the vitamins and minerals you can pick up in 100 to 200 square feet to balance out the ones that aren't in the calorie crops that you're growing. Why it was lost, I'm not really clear, but I've been teaching now for 10 years the way to grow all your food in 20 hours a year to many people, and only one couple has actually decided to start experimenting with it. I think that we're part of the challenges were creatures of habit. I know I sure am, and it takes time to change that habit. The people just don't believe that they could really do it in that amount of time. But let's look at a couple of other cultures. Let's look at the Hananu in the Philippines. The Iranians were an early Stone Age culture. Let's go to a Stone Age culture. Hananus still exist, and they haven't been impacted by civilization significantly. They're illiterate. They don't read. Therefore, you can understand they don't use computers. 80% of their table conversation is about farming, and their children play farmer, not the kinds of diverse games that people in developed countries play. Now, you might think that these people are at risk, but let me tell you that it's quite the opposite. They are farming literate, and that's what most of us have lost, is farming literacy. We've spent 35, 40 years becoming computer literate, but you can't eat those chips. Now, the Hananu have a 200 crop. Hear that? 200 crop, incredible. 5-year rotation system. It contains 40 different varieties of rice every year.
Wow.
So no matter whether the weather's too hot, too cold, too wet, or too dry, they get enough calories. They know what calorie farming is, and how it's the basis of everything. So then you can go forward in time a whole lot to the Mayan culture that we just talked about. And they seem to understand that. But there's a question here, and this is a really important question for world farming today, beyond small scale even. And that is, why did the Mayan culture finally disappear? And no one knows. There's 5 or 6 reasons. But one of them very easily could be that they didn't practice biologically intensive farming sustainably.
So they farmed the soil out and there was nothing left to take from the soil then.
Right. Like organic farming is 50-84% not sustainable. And the reason why is it imports 50-84% of its organic matter in compost and manure form and nutrients in organic fertilizer form from the outside. So even though our soils may be really good, we're depleting other soils. And there's probably only 67 years worth of farmable soil left in the world. So we really have not...
That's not very good news.
No, we don't just have peak oil. We have peak farmable soil. Now, with grow biointensive, you can produce, if you do it sustainably, and once you build up your soil and your skill reasonably, that doesn't have to be the best skill or the best soil, you can actually grow soil. So what happens in the world as a whole is every time we eat 1 pound of food grown by various techniques, 6 to 24 pounds of farmable soil are lost due to wind or water erosion resulting from the types of practices being used. These aren't my data. These are data that come, you know, from very recognized organizations. Now, with grow biointensive, if you use it properly, it has the capacity to produce 2 to 4 times and even higher the yield. But it also, per pound of food eaten, it can produce up to 20 pounds of farmable soil, not lose 6 to 24, but actually grow up to 20 pounds of farmable soil. How do we know? There was a test done by a master's student, Doug Mayer, at the University of California, Berkeley Soil Science Department, and he discovered that we were building the soil 1 inch worth in 8.5 years. Normally, to build 1 inch of farmable soil in nature takes 500 years in the United States as a whole. So we were building soil 60 times faster than normally occurs.
So what I'm sensing here is that there seems to be 2 kinds of agriculture, and one which suggests that farmers get big or get out, that's includes organic agriculture as well, as I understand it, because they're using inputs from outside, relying on a lot of inputs from outside. And then there's this whole other space-intensive production technology that relies on biologically intensive soil techniques that actually reverse the loss and build soil.
Right. I think that what we all need is have T-shirts that say "Grow Soil," because that's really where it's at. If you have a healthy soil, the soil will grow healthy plants, and actually healthy plants have very few insect and disease problems. If you look at conventional agriculture, you will discover that even if you use every pesticide, herbicide, birdside, and rodenticide known to humankind, that 37% of the crop is lost. It used to be that only 34% of the crop was lost.
Wow.
Now, if you use none of those, 42% of the crop is lost. So it's getting to the point where with all the poisons, we're having a kind of yield that is very close to what we'd get if we were using no poisons.
Holy smokes, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Heating What Radio, with John Jevons aboard with us today. Oh, my goodness, the big man of small farms. We're talking not about being green. We're talking about becoming brownies, soil people. We're talking about building soil that will support a whole bunch of food, and that food will support us. And we can thus figure out how to feed this world on small parcels of land. You can join us, 831-479-1080, right back with John Jevons. Do stay tuned. Well, folks, he's here, the big man of small farms and gardens, John Jevons, the author of How to Grow More Vegetables and Fruits and Nuts and Berries, Grains and Other Crops Than You Ever Thought Possible on Less Land Than You Can Imagine. Case in point, it takes, some say, big agriculture, conventional agriculture, approximately 30,000 square feet to feed one person, whereas this space-intensive, biologically intensive production technology that John writes about in How to Grow More Vegetables can do it in 4,000 square feet. John, let's kind of focus in on what the technology that you're bringing, I guess, back to the world from cultures past, and adding a lot of modern technology to it as well, I assume, correct?
I think a modern understanding. I don't know if it's a modern technology per se.
A spade is still a spade, right?
Yeah, that's right. So what the way that we're able to miniaturize agriculture, and it's not that we did it, actually, we're just relearning what people in Asia, Greece, and Latin America have known for hundreds and thousands of years. So by preparing the soil really deeply in a way that eventually you just need to surface cultivate once good soil structure is established, and so you do even, you know, less manual preparation, combined with the use of compost, you're able to get four times the plants on the average in the same growing area. And because the soil is prepared 24 inches deep for good soil structure instead of the 5.8 inches deep in conventional agriculture and maybe, say, 10 inches in normal gardening, you get 2 to 4 times the nutrient cycling. This enables you to get yields per plant that can be, they may not be, but they can be as high as if you had them in the wider row spacings.
Wow.
So it's really it's amazing. It appears to be miraculous. I had one man from Missouri who heard me talk about 10 years ago, and he called in a year later, and he said he tried it against what he had been doing previously. He did his normal growing area, and then he did a few beds, and he got about 9 times the productivity. I don't expect most people to get that. We have had that and higher with cucumbers, but and zucchini. At any rate, he was delighted. Perhaps he had a bad soil, and so the leverage was even greater for him.
Well, so just think of that, folks. 9 times the productivity. So what you have been getting out of your garden or farm, perhaps you could get as much as 9 times that. Wow.
Which means you can do it in a smaller area. So the increased yield, people shouldn't count on 9. They should think about, 2 to 4 times, as they build mm-hmm. up their soil and as they build up their scale. So this means that you can reduce the area needed to grow your food from the 30,000 square feet down to 15,000 or even 7,500 square feet. And how has it gotten down to 4,000 square feet? And we know how to get it way below that. But let's just stick with 4,000 square feet right now. It's a different kind of diet. And this different kind of diet is based on a type of crop selection or planning recipe that is the following. 60% of your growing area, so if you had 10 beds, 6 beds, a bed is 100 square feet for us, 6 beds would be in winter and or summer grains. Then 30% of our growing, and the reason why is because they produce a significant amount of calories and a tremendous amount of dry biomass for making compost.
Mm-hmm.
If we're going to make our farming and gardening sustainable, we need to produce our own compost materials.
Right. So with the grains, you get a twofer. You get calories and you get carbon.
Exactly. Now, then what we need to do is grow 30% of our area. In this case, if we had 10 beds, 3 beds, just to pick a number of beds out of the air, in special root crops that concentrate calories. And there's 7 that do this. Potatoes, sweet potatoes, garlic, salsify, Jerusalem artichoke, leeks, and I'm spacing one out. Did I say salsify? I think I did. At any rate, these crops can produce 5 to 20 times the calories per unit of area per unit of time compared with the grains.
Wow, so you get much more calories out of less time and less space.
Exactly.
But not as much carbon.
But not as much carbon except for 2 varieties of hardneck garlic. The 2 varieties of hardneck garlic, they can produce a significant amount of garlic and a significant amount of carbon or dry biomass are German porcelain and Polish gin.
Hmm.
Now, most hardneck garlic produce a lot less edible garlic per plant compared with softneck, but these 2 varieties do different. In addition, most Jerusalem artichoke takes 6 months or so to mature, but Johnny Selected Seeds has several varieties that mature in 3 months.
Wow.
And Jerusalem artichoke only produces about half of the amount of dry biomass that those 2 varieties of hardneck garlic produce. It produces about 15 pounds, but most other of your special root crops, your 30% crops, only produce 5 pounds. So by careful varietal selection, you can make a really large difference. Now, there's...
What about the good stuff?
What's the good stuff?
Well, the veggies, of course. You know, that all of the thing that vegetarians look for, the carrots and tomatoes and lettuce and stuff.
So out of 10 beds, we recommend a 40-bed unit for growing all your dietary needs, but I'm using 10 because it's easy mm-hmm. to conceptualize. So out of a 10-bed unit, 1 bed would be in vegetables.
Just 1/10.
Yeah, and you could be growing from that area 150 pounds to 300 pounds or more of vegetables. So that would be a pound a year kind of thing. If you want more, you just put in another bed. But uh-huh. if you're trying to condense the area it takes to grow your food in, then you don't need to. You can eat those because I love them and they're wonderful. But in order to get your complete balanced diet and get the missing vitamins and minerals that are not in the 60% crops and not in the 30% crops. You only need a very small area to round that off in. We're gonna have to
take a quick break, but when we come back, can we talk a little bit about the importance of compost? You talk about making all of this carbonaceous material from the grains, but why is that important to soil structure and to soil health and to the health of the garden and the productivity of the garden? This, all this, John Jevons, the man, the big man of small-scale agriculture, how to grow more vegetables and everything else on less land than you thought possible, right back. Hey, folks, we're back, and we're talking about how to get more, much, much more, up to 9 times more, in fact, out of your small garden or farm, and we're talking with a big man of small farms and gardens, John Jevons, he, the author of How to Grow More Vegetables and everything else on less land than you thought possible. John is his book How to Grow More is now has 500,000 copies out there in the world, and people all over the world are looking into the pages and learning about this whole notion of growing with biologically intensive soil practices. And I guess at the foundation of those practices is compost, right, John?
That's very true. And one of the things that I'm especially excited about, and in the new edition, the 2012 edition of How to Grow, in the last 3 pages of the compost chapter, you can find that there are 5 different ways that you can increase the quantity and or quality, very possibly, of compost, so that you're getting the power of up to 8 times the amount of compost power.
Wow.
Some of these things are given, like if you're producing double the yield, you get double the compost. You know, if you have the double the yield of compost crops and you build a compost pile, you're going to get twice as much compost. So that's, you know, pretty straightforward. Mm-hmm. There's another thing that I found in a booklet, a biodynamic booklet on compost, and it said that if you build cold compost, which is, you know, everybody will run shrieking into the forest around that one, but it's really not as tricky as it sounds. But if this booklet said if you do cold composting, you can get up to double the amount of cured compost out per unit of material in.
Now, how on earth does cold compost, is that anything like cold fusion?
Well, what happens is that when you have a hot compost pile, essentially you're burning up the material.
Right.
If you have a cold compost pile, it's molding. And it's a different process. So the first time we tried it, we got 38% more cured compost out per unit of material in. We ran a control, and we got, when we did it the hot way, we got less. And we did it the cold way, we got more. Now, people say, well, I'm going to get weed seed, I'm going to pass through insect larvae, I'm going to pass through disease organisms. But in point of fact, if you want to eliminate 100% of those things you don't want, you have to take your pile up to 178 degrees Fahrenheit. You do that, you're going to burn away a lot of your carbon, a lot of your biomass, a lot of your cured compost. And
left with ash.
If it's just sort of like a bonfire.
Right.
So if instead you do a cooler pile and you put the right amount of organic matter in your soil, and you weed, you don't properly, you don't let your weeds go to flower and produce seed, you can end up not passing weeds through, and you have a healthy soil, so you don't really have many insect larvae that are harmful or pathogens.
You know, this brings up the most interesting thing of all with respect to what it takes to do the kind of agriculture that you're talking about, John, in that conventional agriculture really has gotten big by substituting money for time, time being the farmer or the laborer. So we've gotten rid of the people. We've taken them out of the field because they were relatively more expensive than money. And so we could use money to buy equipment, and we could use money to buy chemicals and whatnot. But you've gone exactly the opposite direction here. And what your technology relies on as extremely smart people. I think of the Philippines that you were talking about and their 200 crop rotation. Wow, that's genius stuff. Where are we going to get where are we going to get all these smart people that you need?
Well, you know, we don't really need to be smart. We just need to use a little common sense. Remember the Honda News?
Mm-hmm.
They're illiterate. And they have a 200 crop, 5-year rotation system that contains 40 different varieties of rice every year. If you go to rotation systems that are in a gigantic computer, there's not anything that comes close to that.
I know, but that they might be illiterate, but they're certainly not stupid. They're very smart, and they're very well educated with respect to what they're doing.
And they're very real. So we can be the same. We can use our common sense. We can use our intuition, and we can be equally effective. We just need to begin. The Chinese call their farmers living libraries because they know that they know more than 4 millennia of tradition. They know more than they learned at the agricultural college or university if they went to one. And they know that they know more than they've learned during their lifetime on their own farm. So they just have the feel for it. And I think until the Second World War, a very large number of our family members were on family farms, and I think we have, you know, the genes, the DNA, if you will, that will enable us to reclaim this common sense.
Well, you see it happening here and there. You see people like John Jevons doing it. You see people like the kids up at the University of California Santa Cruz Farm and Garden Project. You see it happening here and there. You see small farmers serving the city with this kind of biologically intensive production technology, and you see the food coming out of there being sought by city consumers at the farmers market and at CSAs. You see the beginnings of this happening. But the big question is, when it comes right down to the nitty-gritty, who's going to feed the world? Is it going to be that big agriculture that relies on all of those inputs? Or is it going to be the small agriculture that relies on people and the intelligence of the gray matter of the brain and the skill of the hands and the materials at hand? What do you think? We will be right back with the big answer from John Jevons himself. Do stay tuned. Well, folks, it is technically possible to grow more vegetables and fruits, nuts, berries, grains, and other crops than you ever thought possible on less land than you can imagine. John Jevons has the technology, and others do as well, based simply on biologically intensive soil practices and other very simple production technologies. So it is technically possible for us to do this, to feed ourselves on less land than we ever thought possible. But is it politically possible? And that's the thing that has me scratching my head these days. And I wonder, John Jevons, as a student of politics, as you were in college, how do you think small agriculture can survive a government that has become completely dominated by large or big agriculture? I mean, I'm thinking, of course, of Monsanto's Michael Taylor sitting right there in the catbird seat at USDA and FDA. How are we going to survive that?
Well, I think there's a lot of change happening that we don't generally see because it requires reading a lot of large reports and newspaper articles and many other things. Actually, the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, Bill Gates, the World Bank, and many other such organizations are now saying that for most of the people in the world in the future, it is going to take small farming, small-scale farming, in order for people to be fed. So that hasn't been actualized very much yet into action, but at the policy level, there's a common agreement that for most of the people in the world, this is going to have to occur. So I think it's a matter of time. Then how do we accelerate the process, and how do we shorten the amount of time that it takes that to happen? I think in part by just doing it. A I'll give an example. In Kenya, East Africa, where we have been teaching grow biointensive sustainable mini farming since 1984, there are now an estimated number of 2.5 million farmers using grow biointensive practices. It spreads by word of mouth. When a class scheduled for 50 people begins, actually 100 people often show up, people that no one expected to come. So this sort of voting by doing is, I gonna think, going to make most of the difference.
Margaret, do you have a quick comment?
Yeah, I wish Michael Olson were in that bird seat. He would save the world. I understand that hemp neutralizes the soil.
John?
I'm not an expert on that, you know, soil amendment, so you could be very right. I don't know that.
Well, thank you, Margaret. And thank you, John Jevons, for the wonderful work you're doing, for bringing a new way of looking at food and farming to the world. I guess it's for bringing an old way of looking at food and farming back to our consciousness. I mean, you've been plugging away at this for 30 years and been one of my heroes for that long. And your new book, your revised book, How to Grow More Vegetables, is certainly a big part of my library and always has been. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you all for tuning in to Food Chain. Stay tuned next week for more What's Eating What Radio right here on the Food Chain.
Listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.